Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 18, perfection of renunciation, beginning with text 36. Sukham tvi danim trividam. Shrinu me bharatarshava. Abhyasa ramate yatra. Dukhantam cha nigacchati. Sukham, happiness. Tu, but. Idanim, now. Trividam, of three kinds. Shrinu, here. Me, from me. Bharata Rishabha, O best among the Bharatas. Avyasat, by practice. Ramate, one enjoys. Yatra, where. Dukham, of distress. Antam, the end. Cha, also. Digachati, gains. Translation of purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. O best of the Bharatas, now please hear from me about the three kinds of happiness by which the conditioned soul enjoys and by which he sometimes comes to the end of all distress. Purport, a conditioned soul tries to enjoy material happiness again and again. Thus he chews the chewed, but sometimes in the course of such enjoyment, he becomes relieved from material entanglement by association with the great soul. In other words, the conditioned soul is always engaged in some type of sense gratification. When he understands by good association that is only repetition of the same thing, and he is awakened to his real Krishna consciousness, he is sometimes relieved from such repetitive so-called happiness. Text 37. Yattaragre vishamiva parinami ritopamam. Tat sukham satvikam proktam atma buddhi prasadajam. That which in the beginning may be just like poison, but at the end is just like nectar, and which awakens one to self-realization, is said to be happiness and the mode of goodness. Purport, in the pursuit of self-realization, one has to follow many rules and regulations, to control the mind and the senses, and to concentrate the mind on the self. All these procedures are very difficult, bitter like poison. But if one is successful in following the regulations and comes to the transcendental position, he begins to drink real nectar and he enjoys life. Text 38. Vishayendriya samyogad yattaragre mritopamam parinami vishamiva tatsukam rajasam smritam. That happiness which is derived from the contact of the senses with their objects, which appears like nectar at first but poison at the end, is said to be the nature of passion. Purport, a young man and young woman meet, and the senses drive the young man to see her, to touch her, and to have sexual intercourse. In the beginning, this may be very pleasing to the senses, but at the end, or after some time, becomes just like poison. They are separated, or there is divorce, there is lamentation, there is sorrow, etc. Such happiness is always in the mode of passion. Happiness derived from a combination of the senses and the sense objects is always a cause of distress and should be avoided by all means. Text 39. Yat agre chanubande cha sukhamohanam atmanaha. Nidralasya pramadoktam tattamasam udaritam. And that happiness which is blind to the self-realization, which is delusion from beginning to the end, which arises from sleep, laziness, and illusion, said to be the mode of ignorance. Purport. One who takes pleasure in laziness and in sleep, certainly in the mode of darkness, ignorance. One who has no idea how to act and how not to act is also in the mode of ignorance. For the person in the mode of ignorance, everything is illusion. There is no happiness either in the beginning or at the end. The person in the mode of passion, there might be some kind of ephemeral happiness in the beginning, at the end distress. But for the person in the mode of ignorance, there's only distress, both in the beginning and at the end. Did you go over something about Vamana's appearance day today? You talked about Trivikram and Vamana and Indra and Shukracharya, everything. What's that? Anyhow, we don't have to expand anymore. Now Krishna is concluding his talk about the three modes of material nature, which is supposed to be a summary. 18th chapter is a summary of the Bhagavad Gita, which is supposed to have concluded in the 17th chapter. So the second chapter is a summary, and the 18th chapter is a summary, which leaves 16 chapters, which summarize the entire Vedic literature. And here are the most significant of the modes of material nature, the different types of qualities, and it's a fallen microphone. It can't maintain its service. You have to train it to become steady. That there are different intelligence, there's different knowledge, there's different workers, there's different works, there's different determination, all according to the modes. But the most significant is happiness, because all the other ones are more or less dependent upon that. Those in the mode of ignorance, they actually believe ignorance is happiness. But Prabhupada said there is no happiness in the mode of ignorance. Because in the mode of goodness, there is also no happiness. Prabhupada was asked, what is the happiness in the mode of goodness like? And Prabhupada said, if you think you're happy in the mode of goodness, then you're in ignorance. Because in the material world, there is no happiness. There's only the absence of distress. There's no positive happiness. Even Brahman, which is beyond the material existence, there's no positive happiness. There's just only complete absence of distress. Our main distress is that we think we're temporary. We think that with the end of this body, we're finished. Although we haven't been finished in spite of all the changes of the body, due to ignorance, we're still convinced that after the change of this body, after the demise of this body, after the disappearance of this body, we're going to also disappear. Puff. Where'd he go? He just puffed. That's it. Now, because we enjoy happiness in the modes of material nature, whether especially in ignorance and passion, therefore, we're inclined to be predominantly in ignorance. If we're a worker in the mode of ignorance or passion, if we're doing work in the mode of ignorance or passion, if our intelligence is in the mode of ignorance and passion, if our determination is in the mode of ignorance and passion, in other words, it's progressive. If I work in the mode of ignorance and passion, then naturally, if my work is in that mode, then naturally the worker will probably be in that mode also. And if my work is in that mode, then probably my intelligence will be in that mode. And if my intelligence is in that mode, my determination will be in that mode. In other words, when people are in ignorance, they don't think they're in ignorance, they think they're illuminated. Just like if you take LSD, and you're in some other type of existence, you actually think you're illuminated, you're enlightened. And therefore your intelligence is to spend the rest of your existence in LSD, the world of LSD, the world of enlightenment. But it's complete illusion. On the other hand, people who make a lot of money, get a big house, have all the opportunities for sense enjoyment, they think they've actually come to the platform of perfection, that no one is better than them. Does anyone remember that verse in Bhagavad Gita? That idam te nad, idam adyamaya labdvam, imam prapse manarvatam, idam astiyam apime, bhavishati punardhanam, asamaya hatak shatror, hanishe chapalana pi, ishvaraham humbogi, siraham balavansuki, adyobi janavanasmi, kanyosti sadrishomaya, yakshe dashami modisha, ityagana vimohita. Does anyone know what that means? Any scholar here? That's chapter 16. What's that? I believe it's beginning with text 13 to 16. What's that? To 15. Yeah. Idam adyamaya labdvam. Idam I so much is mine today, and I'll gain more in the future. So much wealth do I have, and still I'll get more. He is my enemy. I've killed him. And all my other enemies will also be killed. I am the Lord of everything. I am perfect. I am powerful. I am happy. I am surrounded by rich and aristocratic relatives. I will give some charity. I have performed some sacrifice. And thus I'll rejoice. In this way, the demoniac are bewildered by ignorance. So do you know anyone who thinks that they're perfect, or they're powerful, or they're happy, or they identify so much they have and they're going to get more in the future, so much wealth do they have, and their enemies are finished, they have plans for their enemies. Know anyone like that? Have you heard of anyone like that? If you go to the movies, which we don't recommend. But what are the movies? In the heroes in the movies, are there humble, saintly people who help others cross the street? Is that the heroes in the movies nowadays? Nowadays, even the most... Previously, the hero used to be somewhat of a good person. But now the heroes are like the most degraded people in the movie, the ones who win. Now the good guys finish last. And the rogues are the ones who are portrayed as the victors, the heroes. So this is people's taste. They have a taste for it. Now in reality, if you wind up killing an ant, you have to pay for it. What to speak of killing animals, and your consciousness is always an anxiety. The more you act in the mode of ignorance, the more you become covered over. Of course, as Prabhupada says, the trees, they're completely in ignorance, they're completely covered, but they don't feel anything, hardly feel anything. So they don't know they're in ignorance, because they don't know anything. So is that the existence we want? Would anyone really want to become a tree in their next lifetime? Standing naked? Without any shame? And not even being conscious. And of course, at the end of this creation of Brahma, at the end, very end of his life, we go into the body of Mahavishnu for 311 trillion 40 billion years. Could you imagine if you say, well, tomorrow you're going to waste 311 trillion 40 billion years. You're going to go to sleep. You think, well, at least I'll get a good rest. You wake up, you're still tired. Could I just get a few billion years more? It's not much. I think I'll feel all right after that. So the motivator is there's no satisfaction, destruction. People are actually happy to see things destroyed, like Banasura. Banasura. After doing so much penance to get 1,000 arms, what he wanted is he wanted to be destroyed. He wanted his arms to be get destroyed. He wanted to get defeated so the itching sensation would go away. Because as soon as you have some power, you have this itching sensation to try to use it. And if you can't use it, you become depressed. You're sitting there in the bunker and you press the button to destroy the world, and you think, oh, I really want to try it out, see what would happen. No. Bang! Oh! Can I take it back? Who pressed the button? No, oh, it wasn't me. I wasn't. So if you have something, you want to use it. So Prabhupada said they made all these weapons out of ignorance. So they're just sitting around trying to figure out when they could use it. Because otherwise, why did they spend so much trouble making it? And in passion, the whole idea is that I'm going to get a better material situation, basically so I can eat better. But who eats better than the devotees? No one eats better than devotees. And even we're not satisfied. No one's happy on the fast. Who's happy on the fast day? You hear, today's a fast day. You're going to fast till midnight. And you go, wow, that's fantastic. Could I fast longer than that? Yeah, you can fast a couple of days. Oh, I want 3 days at least. I'm always looking forward to the fast day. Most devotees are not on that platform. And yet people are making elaborate arrangements just for eating, but they don't know how to eat. Because some people have all these cookbooks and things like that, but they're usually full of dead animals. And it's become so degraded. Now, for instance, there was I forget where it was, they were being over, maybe it was Nevada, they were being overrun with crickets. So the politicians were saying you should capture them and eat them. Now that's not exactly on the high class platform. But even in the restaurants where they serve very, very expensive steaks, they found out that steaks were all actually, they were part of frozen dinners. You paid $300 for a steak, thinking you're getting something very, very sophisticated. But it's just part of a frozen dinner that they made years ago. Or you take caviar, which is supposed to be I think it costs $10,000 for a kilo of caviar, or something more than that. But what is caviar? It's little fish eggs. And people are imagining that they're actually enjoying something very important, very sophisticated. And what is champagne? It's just rotten grapes with some bubbles in it. And yet they're willing to pay an elaborate amount of money for it. Because it's all imagination. So most of the material world is existing on the promise of becoming happy. And of course, if you're going to spend, you know, $1,000 on a meal, you got to pretend it was good. Otherwise, you must be a fool, number one. You're making, you know, $15 an hour and you spend $1,000 on a meal. You got to pretend that this was actually extraordinary. Although you got sick eating it. So, the mode of goodness at least one understands that we have to go through some austerity to fix the mind. The austerity is not just for the austerity, for the sake of it, although some people like that. They feel good doing austerity. Because the subtle body separates from the gross body, and one doesn't feel anything because one becomes like a ghost. So that kind of austerity is considered in the mode of ignorance also. Although they feel good that I'm not feeling any gross material pains because I'm not part of the body anymore. My subtle body is separated. So I'm hovering on the subtle platform. But it's also a kind of anxiety. To become a ghost is not very desirable. So on the other hand, if we perform austerity in order so that we can hear, control the senses better, and therefore be able to hear more clearly Krishna's message, and perform activities with more sense control in Krishna's service, then that's desirable. But it's not very pleasant at the beginning. But it says at the end it's very nice, because it awakens one to self-realization. So that kind of happiness is what we're looking for. The little bit of austerity that we do to fix the mind upon Krishna, and if we fix the mind upon Krishna and we learn to experience Krishna's presence, then there's unlimited happiness because Krishna is unlimitedly happy, and we gain the ability to experience his happiness, then we also become happy. There's no one happier than Krishna or Srimati Radharani or their associates. So our whole idea is do something to become more conscious of them particularly by serving their instructions, and then we can actually understand what real happiness is. Then one automatically, once all the other determinations, the other use of the intelligence, the kind of work we do, etc., will all be focused upon Krishna. Because everything else was insignificant, tuchava, compared to Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, we look around in the world and we see, how can anyone be enjoying actually in the material world nowadays? You don't know where the next problem is going to come from. Even we don't have any idea. Most of the world is just speculating on exactly what bad thing is going to happen next. What kind of unpleasant circumstances we'll find ourselves in. No one's saying that the golden age has come. How many newspaper articles have you read about the Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's golden age has come for 10,000 years? Only very few people know about that, and probably even fewer people even believe it, that we're actually on the verge of a happy era. Because you only find out about it once a year in a class to remind it that we're not in the worst part of Kali Yuga, we're in the best part of Kali Yuga. If we become Krishna conscious, if we take advantage of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy and apply it within our life to our best of our capacity, then we're in the best of possibilities, not the worst of times. There's a book by Charles Dickens, Two Cities, Tale of Two Cities. You read that book? No. I guess it's in American. It was actually a French book. Story of, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It's a story of right before the French Revolution. How the aristocracy was so-called enjoying, and the peasants were suffering. And by the end of the book, everyone is suffering. Everyone had equal opportunity to suffer. So that's Kali Yuga. But we're in the better part because we have an opportunity to actually become happy by taking to the message of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and applying it within our lives. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Any questions, comments? That's a bona fide book.
From this aspect of transcendental service. So here Srila Goswami describes that one who is fit for becoming engaged in devotion service, he said that persons who are neophytes and who have developed a little love for love of Godhead are not interested in the activities of sense gratification in proportion to their devotion. But if there is still some attraction for sense gratification, gratifying activities, then the results of such activities should be offered to Krishna. This is also called engagement in the service of the Lord, with the Lord as the master and the worker as the servant. So I'm thinking that even if we may have some propensity for gratifying our senses, then I'm not able to understand this, how we can still offer that...
Offer the cupcake to Krishna before you eat it. Does that answer your question? No, I mean, one has to eat, one has to sleep, and even mating and defending is allowed under certain restrictions. So, but it should be done for Krishna. In other words, if it's actually done as a service to Krishna, then it's not unrestricted. But even if you eat what's required, that's also sense gratification. The soul doesn't require anything, any food. The soul doesn't require to sleep. The soul doesn't require to mate or defend. These are activities of the body, but they should be done for Krishna and report in what's needed. For instance, if you have salt, if you add too much salt to the food, then it becomes unpalatable. And if you add too little, it's not good either. Then it becomes tasteless. So you have to add salt to the taste, just the amount of salt necessary. So we're supposed to gratify our senses as much as necessary to keep the soul and the body together so we can go on with our service. So that even that sense gratification, we offer prasadam, for instance, to Krishna. We sleep, but of course we always dream about Krishna. And children who are produced in marriage are supposed to be trained up in Krishna consciousness, become devotees of Krishna. And defending, we protect the body so we can engage in Krishna's service. But if we don't do that, if we just eat whimsically or we sleep without any real consciousness behind what we're doing, or we mate just for some kind of recreation, or we're always in anxiety unnecessarily, then these things are not conducive for devotional service.
Also, there is one more I'm thinking about this, that when we have propensity to enjoy the material nature of our senses, gratify our senses. So let's say if somebody wants to, is still addicted to drinking wine or anything like this. So I think I read somewhere, Prabhupada was saying that even if you are drunkard, then if you think the taste of that wine or your favorite champion or whatever it is.
Are you advertising we should drink wine?
No, no.
Just remember, it's the taste is Krishna. He's the taste in water, and wine has water in it. So just remember, Krishna is the taste. Then you'll become a great devotee. He's wandering around the temple intoxicated all the time. He's making a lot of advancement. After Mangalarti, we get our glass of wine, everyone chants Rasa Hamam Sukantiya. Krishna is the taste in the water and the wine. No, Prabhupada was saying that just as an example. He wasn't really serious telling people to drink wine, of course.
One more question. Devotion, service, and friendship. Here it says that the Lord says that a person who has completely surrendered unto me has completely given up all other activities has completely given up all other activities, is protected by me personally, both in this life and in the next. In other words, I wish to help him become more and more advanced in spiritual life. Such a person is to be understood as having already achieved sarshti, having equal opulences with the Supreme. So, can you please explain how in this way one is considered to attain equal opulence with the Supreme?
Well, Krishna gives the devotee whatever he needs. If you can get whatever you need, then you have sarshti. Sarasthi means the same opulence as Krishna. So, in the spiritual world, for instance, the devotees, even in the topmost planet, Goloka Vrindavan, they don't have big houses, they don't have cars, they don't have anything. They live very simply, but their opulence is unlimited because they have unlimited milk products and they have unlimited flowers and nice vegetables and. So this is considered real opulence. Beautiful Govardhan and Jamuna. So this is actually opulence. They don't need all these other things. I mean, even you get the nicest car here or the biggest building, what can you do with it? I mean, you can only sleep on, you only take up a little room when you sleep. What are you going to do with it? Play ping pong all day? So these things are not considered to be very important in the spiritual world in terms of opulence. Beauty, strength, knowledge, wisdom, knowledge, renunciation, fame, wealth, spiritual wealth. These are considered the actually real opulences. Krishna's beauty is, and the devotee's beauty is considered the most important opulence.
So when a devotee has not like material things, but the needs of his life, and if he has the renunciation and beauty and knowledge, all these things, so it is to be understood that he has the equal opulences.
He has whatever Krishna wants him to have. So that way he's equal to Krishna. He has the equal opulences with Krishna. And this, of course, in Vaikuntha, they have the same bodily form as Krishna, and they also have unlimited wealth. They can get whatever they want, but what do they want? I mean, they have beautiful parks there, and they have spiritual airplanes. So they have so much wealth beyond our imagination. But they don't have all this technology, all this industrialization. All this is not considered wealth. It's considered ugra karma. It's considered a burden, actually. Anything else? Yes.
Hi, Krishna. So you're speaking about Satya Yuga and Kali Yuga. Is it already manifested, or is it coming, or is it just depends on our consciousness?
Well, everything depends on our consciousness, because actually we're all spiritual, we're all transcendental to this material world, but because we're identifying ourselves with parts of it, therefore, that's where our experience is. But if we're conscious of Krishna, in Krishna consciousness, then we're in this. Then we're in beyond Satya Yuga. We're in the spiritual world. If we live in the mode of goodness, then we're in Satya Yuga. Then our lives are part of Satya. If we live in the mode of passion, we're in Treta, Dwarpa, and in ignorance, we're in Kali Yuga. Depends on what mode of nature we're living in. In the yugas, just different modes are prominent. I mean, Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha appeared in Satya Yuga. They were not exactly in the mode of goodness. And Ravana appeared in Treta Yuga. He wasn't even a vegetarian. He used to eat sages. So he wasn't exactly in Treta Yuga either. He was in ignorance. On the other hand, Prahlad appeared in Satya Yuga, and he was transcendental. So everything depends on our consciousness. Anything else? Grandharaj Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai.